Radio.
Radio.
Radio. Radio Germaine.
Good morning and welcome to this third episode of Thesis Focus. Today, Finley and I are welcoming Guillermina.
Hi, Guy.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me.
So, Guy, your thesis is on two cities, Santiago, Chile, and Paris, France. Could you maybe just tell us a little bit about your relationship with both of these cities, just to get us started?
Sure. Yeah. So, I am Chilean. I was born in Santiago, although I grew up in the United States. And I'm currently a student living in Paris, France. And in my thesis, it was really important. And I'm very grateful to have studied things that were relevant and that I was actually living in. I think that's really one of the beautiful things about studying urban spaces in general. I also have a background in urban ecology. So a bit of an urban planner is just a part of me and how I approach a lot of things. So that's also a reason why I wanted to study both cities.
So you're studying nature-based solutions, which is a subset of urban planning and also a subset of an adaptation to climate change. So we've got a lot to unpack here, but why don't we start off with the climate change adaptation? There's this very clear divide between adaptation and mitigation. And one of the things that you say in your thesis is that people focus more on mitigation. Why is that distinction significant, and why did you choose to focus on adaptation?
Well, historically, in the short history of climate action, there has been a focus on mitigation. And I think one of the reasons is because we want to stop climate change. And so I think before there was really a lot of evidence for its impacts yet, there was more focus on mitigation. Additionally, mitigation is really a rich country problem. So the largest polluters need to control their mitigation. Whereas adaptation is a problem that's facing countries that have exacerbating climate risks. For example, Chile is a developed country. It's become a member of the OECD in 2010, and it's really doing well. However, it didn't start off on that trajectory and has quite a few climate risks. Access to water is really at a critical point and has a lot of wildfires, a lot of drought that's just been going on for 20 years. On the other hand, France is also dealing with the impacts of climate change. So I think now there's a focus on adaptation because of the fact that we're actually living this and the problem is less invisible than it used to be. So I think that's kind of more of a philosophical or sociological analysis of that. This focus on mitigation led to just a lack of funding and research on adaptation. And you could also maybe constitute that as like a global north, global south divide, because it's a global north problem. Perhaps we've been focusing on mitigation more because adaptation is less of a global north problem, and a lot of the money's in the global north.
And so the type of adaptation which you focused on is called nature-based solution adaptation. Could you explain what that means and then give us a couple of examples in order for us to really understand what you're referring to?
Sure. So nature-based solutions, I think simply put, are leveraging the way nature functions and combining that with human ingenuity. The best example that I can give you from my particular research was in the case of this regional park in Santiago called the Cerro de Renca. So it's the hills of this comuna called Renca. And the nature-based solution here was a little device that was invented in the north of Chile by an academic researcher in the desert of Chile, which is the driest desert in the world. And it's very good at sucking moisture out of the air. And so it's called a fog catcher, essentially, is the term I was going to say in Spanish. In Spanish, it's called atrapa nieblas. And this device was inspired by plants that can also suck moisture out of the air. And in the context of this regional park, they took this device that was utilized in the north of the country and put it on the hillside of this park that is also, they just replanted a bunch of native plants called yuyos, which are in their own form a type of fog catcher. So they're also really good at capturing moisture from the air and bringing it back down. And I think this example, very specific example, is a great example because it shows the human ingenuity in place with nature, with this plant, with this flower that's meant to be on that hill, that's indigenous to this area, but also playing with this technology that was created. So it's a very, very Chilean example, but a nature-based solution can also be, and this is a little part of my thesis, was that I expanded a little bit what nature-based solutions are because it is a concept that comes out of Europe. And so it's not, I would say part of the research was that these concepts, although they might not be explicitly stated in places like Chile, are still occurring in places like Chile, although they might not be saying, this is our nature-based solutions park, or this is our nature-based solutions project. That is very much a nature-based solution, what I just described to you. So in the other sense, a nature-based solution could be a community park. It could be daylighting a river. It could be planting indigenous plants or plants that help pollinators on your windowsill. In the urban context specifically, nature-based solutions, however, also occur outside of the urban context in the form of ecosystem restoration, in the form of agroecology. So it's really just, a broader lens for leveraging nature in terms of trying to solve ecological and sociological issues.
And what's the distinction between, you talk a lot about green infrastructure mm-hmm. and nature-based solutions, so sure. could you just give it a couple of specific examples of green infrastructure and sure. maybe just what the distinction is there?
Yeah, so it's semantics a little bit because green infrastructure is underneath the umbrella of nature-based solutions. And really the point is to put it in the same level of importance as gray infrastructure, like traditional gray infrastructure, like sewage systems or roads, but essentially saying that the park system of a city is a part of the city's green infrastructure, or the tree canopy coverage is a part of the green infrastructure. It's a little bit of like the same thing, but maybe giving more lens to the place specific aspect of it and its overall like systemic connection to an entire area, right? It's not a nature-based solution could be one small park. When you think of it as green infrastructure, you're connecting it to the scale of a city. You're connecting it as a collection of parks, as a collection of community gardens, as a collection of terraces with indigenous pollinating flowers, for example.
So, Guy, tell us more about the two cities that you studied, Santiago and Paris. How are they similar? How are they different? And also, could you explain why you chose to use a comparative approach in your research?
So the reason that I chose a comparative framework, especially when it comes to urban cities, as I'm sure you all know about these partnerships like the C40 initiative, ICLE. So there's a lot of work going on right now about networking cities in terms of climate action. And there's also a movement that I mentioned in my research called a cities everywhere approach, which tries to center ways of knowing coming from traditionally underrepresented regions and cities. And Santiago does in a sense represent this, right? Because it's not a part of Europe and North America, which is really where most urban, mainstream urban academia and urban theory is really coming out of. I'm not saying that that's the only place there is urban theory in academia. It's just really what's been mainstreamed, at least in our Western approach to it. So I think that it's really valuable to compare cities that are so different because you can see what Santiago has to offer Paris and what Paris can learn from Santiago and vice versa. And I think in the context of Paris, oftentimes it's easy to think that we have a lot to learn from Paris, and I think that we do. But conversely, we also have a lot to learn from Santiago. And that comparative lens, I think, is just really fascinating, specifically in the urban context. As to the differences between these two cities, starting off, I think there's quite a few. I mean, Santiago has a colonial roots. It was a city that started in like the 1800s to really take off during and after its independence. And it has gone through a pattern of development that occurs oftentimes in Global South and also was very prominent in Latin America, which is that of informal development. And informal development just essentially means people building the infrastructure and the homes that they need outside of government purview. So there was a lot of informal settlements in the city.
What sort of era are we talking?
This started happening at towards the end of the 19th century, and then by the 20th century was just skyrocketing. all the way up until the 1960s, through the 1960s until, and kind of had a dead end right in 1973 when the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet occurred in the country and was a dictatorship of 17 years. And they essentially obliterated this informal settlement and informal organization that was happening and replaced all of city planning, which beforehand had been messy, yes, but democratic, to this kind of authoritarian neoliberalism is how I phrase it in my thesis. And it's specific, the neoliberalist context here is really critical because I think oftentimes in what we're studying, it's really easy to just throw that word around. With Chile, it is the neoliberalist like guinea pig for a lot of things. So it is where this neoliberalization of public policy goods planning has just gone was absolutely integral to the dictatorship.
And so we're talking here about selling off public services. Mm-hmm. We're talking here about the prioritization of market mechanisms mm-hmm. when with decision making. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Am I missing anything?
The other thing that I would add is that in the case of urban development, it also requires economic justification for urban projects. And this is important because oftentimes investment in public infrastructure might not have a lot of returns on investment. It might not be profitable. For example, green infrastructure, for example, a city park, there might not be a lot of money to make off of a city park. And I think that's a really critical aspect is that now, even today, 20 years after the dictatorship, there's still, and this is another reason why I kind of mentioned that it's this entrenched neoliberalism, right? So the dictatorship's over. I was born 4 years after it ended, but there's still this residual leftover aspect that Chile has to deal with. And that's, I mean, this is not in the thesis. It might be coming more from my own perspective as a Chilean, but there is like this unaddressed issue of the scars of this dictatorship in so many different ways that the country has to address. And in the urban context, I think it plays out in the fact that still to this day, if you want to apply a new urban project, you have to have some sort of economic justification. I'm not saying you have to have a budget. I'm saying you have to show how this project will make money. And that's really difficult because especially with climate action, because climate action might not make you money. So it plays into that. Whereas Paris doesn't really have as profound neoliberalism compared to Santiago. It has more a history of top-down centralized governance, which actually Santiago also ended up being pretty top-down and centralized during the dictatorship in particular. But this top-down and centralized governance, which I would maybe say from a historical lens, started during the Haussmannian period. So Haussmann is this famous kind of architect for Paris, essentially. I guess more of a city planner for Paris. And he was controversial because he kicked a lot of people out of their homes, completely cleaned up the city at the same time, changed it from medieval to the city we know today, but also was a bit cutthroat about it. And I think that this with Napoleon really shows that first kind of wave into that expert first technocratic top down approach that is still really famous for Paris today and also maybe part of the cliche of France in general, that it's that it's very centralized and that it's very technocratic. And this is what we can also call administrative rationalism. So I have these two path dependencies, which is entrenched neoliberalism in Santiago, and for Paris, this entrenched administrative rationalism, which tends to favor the expert and what the expert knows and what the expert thinks should happen rather than other forms of knowledge. And I would say those are still both relevant, although maybe steeped in a little bit of history, still both really relevant to the state of climate policy for both cities, right? Because Santiago has such an entrenched neoliberalism. Its climate framework is very new. Only since 2022 does Santiago, does the whole nation have a regulatory climate framework, whereas France is established one over 10 years ago. And so also Santiago does not yet have a fully established regional plan. It's working on it, right? I don't say there's a lack of political will, but it's just not as established as Paris. Paris is on its second implementation phase of its second adaptation plan. And I think that those are direct products of the path dependencies that I just described.
So just to sum up with a quote, Both city regions are facing fragmentation issues. France is known for a technocratic managerial approach to governance, a sort of administrative rationalism. Chile grapples with legitimizing its governance, managing a recent regulatory climate governance framework, and overcoming neoliberal domination.
Yes, I would say so. If you I did. Do say so myself.
You did. Okay, so getting down to the details of your project, how did you go about collecting the information that you used to build your findings?
This part was honestly so hard and scary. I haven't done really research before, and social science research is interesting because it's all a big ambiguous blur. So I really would describe it as an overall framework of comparative analysis, and I supported answering my question, which is how two distinct cities like Paris and Santiago face the challenge of transformation in policy and practice via nature-based adaptation to climate change. I tried to address that through interviews. So I interviewed 32 policy implementers, researchers, and civil society professionals working in climate action or nature-based solutions. And then I also accompanied that with site visits. So I visited 4 sites in Santiago and 4 sites in Paris. I'll just say that in Santiago, I could have visited more. And in Paris, it was really hard to get people to give me tours. So thank you to the people in Santiago for being approachable. And then I also had to analyze my site visits with a criteria that I created that was informed a little bit by themes I got from the interviews, and then also informed by current standards for nature-based solutions, for what we think nature-based solutions should provide. And then again, all of that was kind of under this overall lens of comparative analysis.
So what were those criteria?
Sure. So some key themes came from the interviews, which was namely that there is a lot of political will for both cities. That was actually one of my first questions. When I first started, I thought that one of the main barriers to climate action would be political will. And I realized that that's me coming across as an American because we're still fighting about whether or not to do something. And in places like Chile and France and Santiago and Paris, we're not debating that. We need to do something about it. Additionally, is that adaptation is inherently transversal. So transversality is actually a term that's used a lot in Spanish, and I thought it was important to try to introduce it in an academic context. And it actually comes from a geometric term, which is just that it's a line intersecting another line perpendicularly. And in English, we'd probably say it's cross-cutting. But I like transversal because I think it's prettier. And I think it's really just trying to encompass there's issues of scale here. We're running across levels of governance. We're running across socio-ecological systems. There's just this transversality to adaptation. There's not just one aspect that it covers. And in considering this transversality, a lot of the people I interviewed also said that adaptation would potentially reveals an opportunity for profound societal transformation. And then we started talking a little bit about what some barriers to that transformation might be. And I think this also plays a little bit back into that neoliberalist or administrative rationalism context, in the sense that for Paris, a lot of the barriers were very technical. So it was like, oh, we have this subway system underneath the city. We don't have any green space. We don't have space. Whereas in Santiago, I would ask what the barriers were. And they were like, our economic model, like there's something missing in our social collective that's stopping us from doing that. That those were not really the answers that Parisian folk were giving me. But both interviews on both sides did say that there was also just a lack of understanding as to what nature-based adaptation really is and how it works. And so these I added to a criteria. So I took key themes like that, namely transversality and this notion of collective transformation from my interviews, and I combined it with some of the criteria for adaptation coming from the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, and then a work by someone called Cabiche et al., who translated that to the urban context. And I came with 3 criteria for looking at my sites through a lens of collective action, which I will say we don't have a lot of collective action criteria for nature-based solutions. We don't have a lot of criteria for nature-based solutions at all. We don't have them broken down into specific contexts, like what is NBS in the agricultural lens? What is NBS in the urban lens? There's not a lot of criteria for that. And so my idea was, how does this actually play into collective action? And so, yeah, there was transversality, which is the ability to cut across vertical political processes or sociological systems. And then there's also co-benefits or co-produced benefits. So nature-based solutions, I would say that's one of the biggest things that comes out of nature-based solutions that's probably the most known, and that's their ability to provide adaptive benefits to the surrounding community, but also economic benefits, also ecological benefits. And then there's also the form, like I said, collective transformation, which is how does this specific site potentially change urban citizenship? Yeah, so that was the rubric that I created.
Amazing. Now, the big question we're left with is, what did you find?
Sure. So what did I find? I found that in Santiago, that it's really important to look in the urban context, both in planning and in practice. I think that if I had just done a comparative policy analysis, I would not have gotten as much information in depth about both of these cities. And I'm really glad that I did site visits. I think that was really crucial. And this might be the urban planner in me, but we have to consider the materiality of things. And I think, and the importance of space, of actually interacting with space. And so, yeah, it's just important to look at it in planning and practice. And in planning, Paris is doing a really good job. They have an established and exemplary climate action planning framework. And they are really doing a great job of making explicit connections to these concepts like nature-based solutions and adaptation. And I think that Santiago would benefit to make those explicit connections in its planning. However, its planning is nascent and almost unpublished. And so it's really hard for me to give like a profound analysis of the policy when one is just almost not fully existent yet, right? So we have some time that we need to investigate Santiago in the context of its planning.
Do you mean in the context of planning or in the context of adaptation planning?
In the context of adaptation planning, but I would also say in the context of urban planning, you know, because they go hand in hand. So yeah, its urban development is also critical, but it's at this stage, I don't think that any city is not considering adaptation to climate change in its planning. So in practice, these site visits and looking at these place-specific community-oriented projects. So in Santiago, a lot of the projects are just very community-oriented. So I mentioned a little bit earlier, it was important to visit sites and it was important to consider two different cities just because Santiago doesn't explicitly say a project is nature-based or doesn't explicitly say a project is adaptive does not make it not so because green infrastructure is inherently adaptive, right? Green infrastructure is inherently a nature-based solution. And something as small as a community garden is a nature-based solution. It is a green infrastructure because it automatically increases biodiversity. It automatically creates a green space and increases green space for residents. And so, you know, there was a project, for example, that was a community garden called the Huerta de Conchalí. But it wasn't made for adaptation. It wasn't made for climate action. I had to kind of attach it to that through this collective action lens. And I think that in that sense, Santiago, even though it's been dealing with this lost notion of a collective, as someone poetically said to me in one of our interviews, actually has a lot of really community-oriented work going on and actually has a lot of ground-up approaches, even if they're coming from national level programs like this project of the Huerta de Conchalí is actually a part of a national initiative to increase sense of place for neighborhoods that have been traditionally marginalized or left out, that have a history of informal informality in their development. And so it's a national scale program, but it's incorporated at the hyper local level and it requires the support of the community, and it didn't have the support of the community at first. It took years of work from these coordinators who are relating to this national program. And I think that if we can extend that NBS to it and extend adaptation to it, it makes it more powerful because, in addition, the immediate problem for this community wasn't adaptation. It was the fact that the space wasn't being used well and that the space felt dangerous. And now they're kind of taking this re-ownership of it. And this is a really, again, very specific example of a community-oriented project. But I think that Paris has a lot to learn from that kind of ground-up approach. And it might be coming from the fact that in Santiago, there feels like there's this lack of institutional capacity to do this at a large scale. And so there is a belief that it must have to be communal. It must have to be from the ground up. It must have to be smaller. Whereas in Paris, it feels a little bit more large scale and things are kind of more specialized and very organized still. But there's maybe not that messiness that comes that's organic, that's good. And I don't say messy in a bad way. I say messy in that kind of organic way.
So if you had to sum up the kind of state of the nation in a couple of sentences, how would you do that?
So essentially, in the planning context, Paris is doing really well, and it has explicit connections to adaptation and NBS projects, whereas Santiago has more of a nascent framework, and its focus is coming more from communal practices that are not always explicitly NBS or adaptation. But in practice, Santiago has more of a community-oriented approach, which might be coming from a lack of institutional capacity, and Paris might actually be underestimating the power of its citizens because of its administrative rationalism and really focusing more on specialized activities and very organized framework for a kind of top-down adaptive approach.
So if we go from this kind of general picture and these examples that you've given us, how did you build that picture from the site visits that you carried out?
Okay, so I think the site visit, I really wanted to do site visits because I just wanted to see it in action. I didn't want to just talk to people. And I will say, I think one of the limitations to my research is that I didn't talk to citizens. I interviewed people working in the space, but I didn't necessarily interview people interacting with those spaces, which is, you know, I didn't have the time. But the site visits, I think, were really interesting because they just helped personify the nature-based solutions. For example, I visited an eco park in this comuna called Peñalolén, which is increasing community-based composting through integrated education initiatives. And they're hoping to kind of change the ecological literacy, essentially, of the comuna through compost. This was just really interesting and kind of looking back at the collective transformation potential of a nature-based solution, right? So this park, again, not explicitly made for adaptation, not explicitly labeled as a nature-based solution. However, it's a part of the transformation of what urban citizenship means for this comuna. And that's really critical. They have thousands of school children and thousands of residents come through their site. And it's very small, and they're still processing the compost of 8 ferias, or 8 marches of the comuna. And this project has now led to plans for an industrial scale composting site for the comuna that's just outside of the site. So I think just kind of showing how these things progress and how these things evolutionize and how critical the engagement of people are, you know. So there's another example. Let me give you an example for Paris, which is the Maison du Jardinage. It's in the 12th arrondissement, and it's essentially working to increase neighborhood stewardship through nature people connections, which they do that through workshops on gardening and hope that that can lead to a more localized ecological knowledge of gardening. And then they take that and integrate it into neighborhood space because there's such a lack of green space in Paris. The idea is, how can private gardeners take these practices and apply them across the city? So then we have this kind of transversal, place-specific application of NBS at the individual level, and also, in addition, hoping to change the perception of what vegetation is appropriate for the city. So there's just these sites that are doing a lot of really critical work in shifting what urban citizenship means while giving us all the co-benefits of nature-based solutions. So I think just in general, something that I liked about my research, or something I found, was that it's really important to look at adaptation and climate action and climate change in general as an opportunity for changing what it means for us to engage in our communities. And I think that's what got me really passionate about this project.
And I think that's a really nice note of kind of potential to wrap up on. If you had to make a slightly more general prescription, what do you see as the future of kind of urban citizenship and climate adaptation?
Okay, this is like the utopian in me, but I see I like cities. I think there are stages. There were things are happening. There were problems happen. There also were solutions are made. And so I see a future where we all have access to parks that we helped build, and that they're parks that are helping us survive this crazy problem that we've created for ourselves, which one of them is climate change, you know? And so I hope that we can, maybe it's like too romantic of me, but maybe we can just try to look at them as really critical spaces for change, and just also understand the importance of space in these changes, right? So there's obviously, and not just the importance of space, but the importance of our interaction in spaces.
All right. Thank you so much, Gee, for coming to the studio and explaining to us your research and what you did. Thank you for shedding light on these really beautiful initiatives and what people are doing in their cities to adapt to climate change. I definitely hope this inspires our audience to go check out what's going on around them. Research shows that there's many cool initiatives going on around Paris, Santiago, and I'm sure many cities around the world. So yeah. And Finley, I'll see you soon for another episode of Thesis Focus.
Thanks, Guy. Bye-bye.
See ya. Thanks.
Look at that. Woo!
That was the smoothest one we've done.
Oh, look at you guys. You guys have a setup for sure. That was fun.